Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today, broadcasting and video streaming on Facebook and PRM.FM. We're going to be talking with a unique mind in the second part of our program. He is one of the smartest men I know, and we're going to be continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, a look at the emerging millennial generation, its politics, its social values, and its spirituality. This is going to be the beginning of a discussion. It'll take probably a year or longer, where it's my intent to bring in some of the most motivated, educated, and humanistic, spiritual of the millennials to work with those who we know have a lifetime commitment to social issues and the common good, working together, but put them front and center. Let them be the ones running for office, and we be the ones supporting them. Because the days of the independent, very qualified, very knowledgeable candidates running and winning is over. It's never going to happen in our lifetimes again. Yes, there was one effort by Bernie Sanders, but Sanders was despised by the corporate Democrats, loved by the millennials. He had the spark. Jill Stein had the brains and the commitment, but no spark. There's some people have the it, and other people don't. And it's not about being on message, not about having the right solutions. You could have the right solutions, but if you're not the right messenger with those right solutions, it's not going to be used. I believe that there are many highly qualified young people who could take good messages from a lot of wise men and women who've spent decades in social movements and bring them forward from the environment, from economics, from education, from governmental policies, from foreign policies, and work with them so there's a real synergy. We've reversed that. We've only had these aging dinosaurs, these intellectual dwarfs who are running our government, running our policies, running our think tanks, running us off a cliff. It's time we just stopped. And there are a lot of us. I mean, there are not a few thousand. There are tens of millions of us. Just Google it. Just Google progressive radio. Google progressivism, and you'll see. It's not about politics. It's about believing that there are solutions that can help everyone live a longer life, a healthier life, heal the planet, and respect our neighbors. So that's what that interview is going to be about. You won't want to miss that. That's the second part of the program. Also, a little later, I'm going to share with you something you're not aware of. You've heard about all the attacks against Trump. Well, yeah, he deserves a lot of challenges, certainly. But what happens when you create false flags, when you create a false dialogue in order to justify getting someone out of office? Well, it's called fake news. I have experienced that my entire career, where they would promise us that if we only sent a check and got a checkup, we could prevent cancer. It was all lies. And I did a series, the first series of articles in American history on the politics of cancer in a national publication. And there's a big blowback from that, but we were right. In fact, someone who died just last week, Gabe Pressman, one of the deans of American New York journalism, came to me when I was working on this. He said, you know, you're going to take a lot of fire from not just the American Cancer Society and the National Cancer Institute and all the pharmaceutical companies, but the media. They're all on that side. He says, show me the proof that there are legitimate alternative therapies being kept from the American public, and I'll do something with it. Well, I showed him the truth, and to his credit, he was the first. He did a 10-part series based upon my original research that was, I believe he won Emmy for it, that was in New York in on his station. And then 60 Minutes did a special, and 2020 did a special, and then that broke it out of the box. So we at least had a chance to share our message against fake news then. vaccines, fake news. Meat eating against veganism, fake news. That solar is no good, but nuclear is good. If we only had nuclear, it would be too inexpensive to meter. It is completely green. There's no pollution, and it protects the environment. Fake, fake, fake. All lies. But how often do you get someone who actually is part of that being caught on camera saying it? Today you're going to see that at CNN. Today I'm also going to answer questions from our Facebook individuals. I'm going to give you the longevity benefits of the Mediterranean diet. I have a lot of women's health issues I'm going to share in the first part of our program. And we have another part to challenging the fake news by fake science that we shouldn't have saturated fat in the diet because elevated cholesterol means you're going to die of a heart attack. Not true. And who's saying not true? Some of the leading cardiologists who took the time to study the truth. So that's our program. We've got a lot to share. I'm going to start with a study from the University of Massachusetts. And this study, done at Harvard and University of Massachusetts, says the following. Eating more vegetables, protein, may protect against early menopause. This was published in the American Journal of Epidemiology. Now, why is that important? Because most women get their protein 3 times a day, because that's what we've been indoctrinated into believing, and generally get twice what their body needs. You need 0.9 grams per kilogram of body weight. A kilogram is 2.2 pounds. So in general terms, that's anywhere between 35 to 60 grams protein a day, depending upon your age, your body size, your athleticism. And it's not more protein we need if we're athletic. It's more complex carbohydrate. It's more energy you need. But anyhow, for those of us who grew up with our parents believing they were being good parents, if they fed us animal protein 3 times a day, you got bacon and eggs for breakfast. You got generally a grilled cheese sandwich and a glass of milk and a bowl of Campbell's tomato soup for lunch every day for years, right? Nothing new there. Well, they might add a pickle. And then for dinner, you get some variety. And it was almost always the same. If it was Tuesday, if it was chicken night, then that's what you got every Tuesday. It was like ritualized. And Sunday would be the big roast beef, unless you were in my house, because Mom would put the roast beef on before we went to church. And then it would be done when we got back. But because I didn't eat the roast beef, I ate the vegetables. I never knew what a vegetable looked like after it was cooked, because you cook something for 4 hours and it looks like mush and it tastes like mush. But that's how we were raised. So think of all the women who didn't realize that animal protein from any form of animal, including eggs and dairy, and beef and pork and chicken, that it has a byproduct. It is called arachidonic acid. And that arachidonic acid is highly inflammatory. It's so inflammatory, it can create lesions inside the epithelium, that is the inner lining of your arteries. And there's a great possibility for those to break off, literally to burst. And when one of those little lesions burst, you get an embolism, and you can die of a heart attack. But we're still arachidonic acid also, and stearic acids, also create inflammatory cytokines. Cytokines are pro-inflammatory markers, and anytime there's an injury, a tear, a cut, a bruise, a swelling, a rip, a broken, anything, you have all these cytokines. But also with that, you get swelling. And you get a lot of free radicals, and hence swollen joints, swollen legs, swollen arms, shoulders. And that can last for years. So what do? When you get anything that's painful, you take a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, an aspirin, ibuprofen. Problem? You can die. Bleeding of the stomach, bleeding of the intestines, destruction of, by the way, aspirins destroy vitamin C, B6, folic acid, and B12, which are necessary to keep down, in women in particular, what is called homocysteine. That is an inflammatory marker from the liver that tells you if it's elevated, let's say around 17, 18, when it goes up, you have a greater risk of a heart attack or stroke. So, you also have estrogens when you eat meat. Lots of estrogen. If you're overweight, lots of estrogen. When you're stressed, even more estrogen. You have the perfect storm of estrogen. You're overweight. You're on a high-protein diet, which you think is doing you good. It's doing you harm. And you're stressed because you're overweight. And you're diabetic. Now, and you have high blood pressure. Those three things come together and really increase your risk of breast cancer because of the estrogen and ovarian cancer and also heart attack and stroke. So that's the bad news if you stick to the traditional American diet. And yet last evening, no, I was going to talk about this today and I was looking at the science on it. I looked at what are Americans eating. So I went through all of the channels on food, and there are a lot of them, and they're popular. And it's all about meat, and meat cooked in the most horrific way. The way you cook meat, grilling it, that's a big thing now. That's one of the most popular programs, fire, food, something like that. It's grilling something for barbecuing it for 12 hours, 14 hours. In and of itself, just that process of cooking any meat, any flesh, at a high temperature creates a byproduct. It is called a heterocyclic amine. And heterocyclic amines are known to increase your risk of cancer and heart disease and also colorectal cancer, men, prostate cancer, and women, breast cancer. Why aren't we told this? This is so simple. And how much science is backing it up? Over 1,000 studies. And how many studies are backing up the benefits of eating meat? Zero. There's not a single study that shows eat processed meat, eat red meat, and it reduces your risk of heart disease or lowers your blood pressure or lowers your risk of colorectal cancer, prostate cancer. It doesn't do that. It's because it's a $200 billion industry. That's a lot of people making a lot of profit. That's a lot of jobs. That's a lot of lobbying. And that means a lot of political influence. That means a lot of science can be bought. A lot of people are for sale. It just depends upon the price. The higher the pedigree, the more the references and the degrees, the more you pay. But at the end of the day, it's like the old Italian saying, a king and a peasant go in the same dirt. It doesn't matter how many PhDs, MDs, how many degrees, how many deans emeritus you have after your name. If you decide to sell yourself, you're selling the truth. If you sell the truth, you're a pimp. Nothing more, nothing less. And I believe that what we should do from now on in the United States is anyone who's out there pimping, we should put them in a professional pimp outfit. Make them look like a pimp. Have a pimp mobile. And members of Congress should go in dressed. I'd love to see this. This would be worth the price. Have everyone in Congress who's lobbying or taking money from special interest and did their bidding dress up like pimps. They got to talk in pimp language. they got to show their hustle and flow. And then every scientist, every newscaster, we would be pimped America because we already have been. We're just not willing to see the truth of anything. Take away the illusion and you got nothing but pimps in positions of policy. So women go on a plant-based diet. What do I mean? You can get all the protein you need, as I do, from brown rice protein, hemp protein, rice, split pea protein, non-genetically engineered soy protein. These are wonderful proteins. And they've got fiber. There's no estrogen. There is no heterocyclic amines. There's no toxins. And they have lots of good studies, as this study from Harvard and this study from MIT. No, not MIT. This was from Massachusetts. Shows you are getting the protein you need and you can prevent cancers. You don't need meat anymore. But there's some people who are very critical of those of us who are going vegan. Listen to what this guy has to say about veganism.
No, there aren't. They just think that. How many vegans do you know? You know, they're clueless religious. Because what they have is ritual without philosophy, fundamentally. So what's happened in many cases is that as the sophisticated religions, so to speak, have collapsed, what emerges from their ashes are rituals. And rituals are sort of the ground out of which a religion emerges. Vegans, vegetarians, environmentalists, anybody who's an ideologue. You know, and the reason that I would consider those in the religious domain is because they're systems of value. And they're predicated on fundamental assumptions that you have to take on faith. See, that's the thing that's so peculiar, because it really turns out that if you're going to act, and you have to act, you have to make assumptions. And the reason for that is, what the hell do you know? You got to put your ignorance somewhere. And people put their ignorance, they box it up inside their assumptions. And those assumptions vary. So, and then, you know, the other thing is, you got to ask yourself when you're wondering if someone is religious, what you use as a marker. Now, the typical marker would be, I give you a questionnaire and I ask you, are you religious, or do you go to church, or, you know, do you follow the precepts and rituals of something that we would recognize as a standard religion? And lots of people will say no to that, eh? But then you watch them and you think, and this is a Nietzschean observation, what makes you think that the morality that you consider moral hasn't been conditioned to the absolute last degree by 2,000 years or 3,000 years of, in the West at least, Judeo-Christian tradition? It's like all the ideas of, fundamentally, all the ideas that individuals have value, it's like, which is a very peculiar idea. You know, everyone here, all you people virtually, I would suspect, believe that. It's like, why do you believe that? And what do you mean you believe it? What does that mean? And what it means is, you act as if it's true. And I don't care what you say, like, what the hell do you know about what you believe? You know, you come to university, you can probably spout off a few ideologies and rationalize all sorts of complex behaviors, but the idea that you actually know what you're up to or who you are is like, why would you think that? You're the most complicated thing that exists. So you don't think you understand the sun, you know, and the sun's a lot less complicated than you are. So I don't buy.
Okay, those are some views from a professor, very popular one up in Canada, Jordan Peterson. He has a lot of views, and equally as extreme. So let's just deconstruct what he says. He's letting us believe, and his students and everyone who watches him, that veganism and vegetarianism is not anything more than a cult. It's based upon religious principles. We have to take it on faith, and there's nothing else to back it up. Simple reality check. Veganism has increased since 2014, in the last 3 years, by 600%. The greatest jump in veganism in American history is in the last 3 years. I have my own ideas about why. And in fact, one of the largest conferences, which I'm going to be the keynote speaker of, coming up in September, is on veganism. So it's not a cult. It's the fact that people are becoming vegans primarily for three reasons. First, it's more educated people who have the science to back it up why it's healthy for them. More doctors are putting their patients on a vegan plant-based diet because it's shown in the scientific literature from quality studies, from studies that are classic studies that would reverse heart disease, clogging of the arteries, high blood pressure, elevated triglycerides, and cancer markers, bringing them down substantially, helping prevent women from breast cancer, men from heart disease, prostate cancer, in the Framingham study, in the nurses study, in the doctor study. Now, those two studies, the last two studies, have over 120,000 people and are the longest going studies outside of Framingham in American history. Over 40 years, those studies have been going on. I have in my possession more than 3,000 studies, independent, high quality studies published in peer-reviewed literature that now tell us why we should have plants in our diet. The polyphenols, the quercetins, the antioxidants, the anti-inflammatories, and nutrients that actually help repair DNA, like blueberries for the brain, pomegranate for the arteries, best thing you could take for your arteries, and for help prevent breast cancer. And the high level of antioxidants. How much antioxidants you get in a steak? None. How about in lamb? None. Fish? None. Dairy? None. Well, how much fiber do you get, which we know is directly related to our digestive health? None. How many studies, sir, can you show me that prove that eating a meat-based diet, the one you advocate, the one you consume, is good for your health? Let's say preventing breast cancer, preventing heart disease, lowering blood pressure, preventing constipation? None. So here we have it. We have science, real science. You're a psychologist. There is no real science there, but we'll give you the benefit of having some decent ideas, possibly. This just isn't one of them. This is reactionary, fake news. But as long as you control your own form, you can share all the fake news you want. But there's another reason many of us become vegan. It's because if we respect life. I respect all life. I don't recognize blacks, Latinos, Chinese. I respect one life, all life. I do not see how we should be parsing individuals by their culture, their ethnicity, as if somehow one has a greater value than all. If you start off respecting all life as sacred, then you're not going to want to abuse it, deny it, neglect it, or hurt it, invade it, occupy it, imprison it, enslave it. You're not going to look at how you can exploit it. But if you look at people as manifest destiny would look, then whoever's the strongest, the smartest, wins. Everyone else loses, therefore can be subjugated to your will. So we don't want to eat an animal. If you have a cat or dog, you're not going to want to eat it. You're not going to want a neighbor to come say, "Hey, friend, we're having a barbecue. Let's put your dog on the grill." You're going to say, "That's gross." Why? Because you've created a relationship with your dog and cat. They understand you. You feel, they feel, they understand what your moods are. And they're there for one reason only, to love you their entire life. Did you ever see a dogger betray you? Gossip about you? Try to abuse you, use you? Never. Unconditional love, no matter what we do to them. So there's a lot of spiritual connection between that sentient being. And that's true of anything else. And we don't want it to suffer pain, which it does when it's slaughtered and how it's raised. And we also care about our environment. I don't know your views on the environment, but if I followed up, I would be interested to see, are you climate change denialist? There are a lot of them, including in academia. But the reality is, yesterday we had the hottest day ever recorded in any city in the world, 167 degrees, 167. Remember, you're going to boil water over at 220. That means it would be impossible for people to go out and stay out in that heat and live. And that was in Iran. And now that's becoming the new norm. Our whole earth is in tipping point mode with positive and negative feedback loops. And those of us who see what's happening have done what we can personally. Now we are working with others who have a common mindset to try to see how can we individually and collectively, how can we feed people when the soils are too hot or too wet to sustain sustain seed life. Others, as long as they can afford food, they don't care where it's grown, who grows it, what the conditions are, they just want it on their plate. But it's worthwhile taking a look where our food comes from, animal food, and how much of a carbon imprint that leaves. So if we all became vegan, we would eliminate as much carbon. Actually, we're eliminating methane, which is anywhere from 56 to 68 times more of a contributor to global warming than CO2. So here's what we have to do. We have to realize that's almost 18%. Or put it another way, if we all went plant-based, we would eliminate as much pollution and heat-trapping gases as are caused by all trains, all planes, all boats, all rail, and all cars and buses and trucks combined. That's a big positive. Now, it's not going to happen that way, but at least those of us who are trying to minimize our carbon footprint are also most likely to be vegan. And those of us who care about all life are most likely to also be vegan. So we have science, we have ethics, we have spiritual values, and we have reason. What do you have on your side outside of a dogma, an anger that you express to a captive group? Those are my thoughts. Now, I'm going to answer some of the questions from people who address this on Facebook. This comes from Juan Perez. Juan, you say, is Gary still doing the runs on Sunday morning in Central Park? Yes, absolutely. Lots of fun. In fact, someone commented this last Sunday, they should have a documentary or, you know, like a reality show of just us running because it's so much fun. We have a ball. And it's free. It's a public service. We start at 9 o'clock at 5th Avenue and 90th Street inside Central Park. And this is from Paul Zarchin. Hello from Phoenix. Used to listen to you in the early 80s. Well, I'm glad that you're back listening and watching now, Paul. And Carol, a beautiful vision. Keep dreaming. That was based upon yesterday me suggesting that we reverse our entire political dialogue in America and start trusting, encouraging, supporting younger people to come up and work with those of us who've been in different movements, work together as a partnership going forward. But we step back where there is a support system, where there is coaches and special counsel, and let them take their full face. I can assure you there'd be a lot better than any president we've had since Eisenhower. And this is from Marilyn Kaplan. Marilyn says, Gary, my son teaches in an inner city school, and all they do is teach to the test. The whole scene is beyond frustrating. Thank you for sharing that, Marilyn. Here's my concern. I've been teaching college for 35 years. So you get some experience. And one of the very first things I do on the very first day of class is I ask each of the learners, I don't like to call them students, I like to call them learners, they're learn. I say, what do you want to learn? What would be the benefit to you of being able to get something unique from this class? What is that uniqueness you're looking for? And then they think about it, and then they tell me, well, I came because I want to do this. And then I try to weave their needs, why they're there, into it. Because when you're addressing someone directly and you're trying to give them insights, then their mind starts to open. Their energy opens. Remember, when we feel free, energy expands. When we feel threatened, angry, energy constricts. Look at someone who's angry. It's all up here in their throat. They're tense. When someone is relaxed and at ease, their body's at ease, they flow. For those of us who are runners, we know that the easiest way to run is run relaxed. So you're running as a meditation. Your body's more fluid. Your legs stretch. When you're running under tension, you're tight. You cramp. The mind can cramp or the mind can expand. What we need is we need a revolution in education to first say, what is the purpose of being here? And it should not be to take and pass a test at all. It should be to help encourage a critical way of thinking. And if we do that, then we've done a good service, because then they're going to leave there with tools they can use in the broader world. We should also teach them about the world. In other words, have nothing that is didactic, nothing that is static, nothing that is existential to the real world. Make it intimate. Ask Bob, Bob, if you were to tell us something about where you live and how you live, what do you need to know to help you better live in that environment. And then suddenly you're going to get the learner asking you things that are not in the textbook, but can help them. So we need something other than this whole fraudulent system of tests. And this is Kathleen Russano, from New York City to California, listening for 30 years. Thank you. And Joyce Gibney, I love your show, Gary, and the sound is fine. So I don't see any other questions, but if you have questions, by all means, ask, and I'll be happy to address them. That's our health and nutrition part. We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, I'm going to share something about Libya before we go to our guest that's really, really important that you listen to. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Before we go to our guest in just a moment, the wonderful Professor Andrew Harvey. I believe he was the youngest professor in Oxford University history. I'll ask him. We're going to talk about the new millennial generation, its politics, social values, and spirituality. I want to share this. This is from Brad Hoff from Foreign Policy Journal, highly respected. And by the way, all of these articles that I quote from, we post. We post them on GaryNall.com, articles. We post them on PRN, so you'll have a chance. Listen what he says. This is important. Quote, newly disclosed emails show that Libya's plan to create a gold-backed currency may compete with the euro and dollar was a motive for NATO's intervention. Now, what does that mean? It means that Libya, at the time that we invaded it, was the Paris of Africa. Of all 54 countries in Africa, it was the most prosperous, had no debt, had tens of billions of dollars in reserve, had the most democracy of any country in the world. They had local communities where the citizens in every town got to actually rule on what was important for them. Oil reserves would go into the general account and then be shared with all of them. They had the best educational system in Africa, and it was free. They had they had free medical care, state-of-the-art hospitals, and if they couldn't help you in Libya, they paid your way to go to any hospital in the world to be treated free. Every married couple got their own apartment and home. Every Libyan had a home. In fact, Gaddafi lived in a tent until he said that every person in Libya had a home before he and his own parents did. And yet, we decided that the safest of the country, the one that was fighting terrorism, the one that was wanting to prosper, wanted to have its own currency. So all the African nations that historically have been colonies and brutalized by the British, by the Dutch, by the Belgians, by the French, and Germans, these countries could now have a single currency, the gold denier, that they could use to trade in all their purchases and no longer use the U.S. dollar. Man, that was a signal. It was over for him. He didn't know it. Now, last year, more than 3,000 new Hillary Clinton emails from the State Department and historians and took a look at these emails. And what they found was that Hillary had death squads. Yeah. Intelligence brief, March 27, 2011. Archived on Libya, sent by long-time close advisor to the Clintons and Hillary's unofficial intelligence gatherer, Sidney Blumenthal, contains clear evidence of war crimes on the part of NATO-backed rebels that we supported, the United States, Britain, France, citing a rebel commander source, quote, speaking in strict confidence, Blumenthal reports to Hillary, under the attack from Allied air and naval forces, the Libyan army troops have begun to desert to the rebel side in increasing numbers. The rebels were making an effort to greet those troops as fellow Libyans in an effort to encourage additional defections. Source, speaking on in strict confidence, one rebel commander stated that his troops, quote, continue to summarily execute all foreign mercenaries. But who are foreign mercenaries? And here's where it gets interesting. These were the people working. They weren't mercenaries. They were just workers. They were black. And they were coming from Africa, from Niger and other countries, Mali. And they would come in because the working conditions for migrants working in Libya, in the oil fields, and in the great canal that he had built, they were all killed. How many of these innocent civilians, unarmed, were killed? Over 20,000. And it talks also about who was funding. Now, this is in the email from Sidney Blumenthal to Hillary Clinton, and it talks about the people who are funding all this, funding the radical extremists, the terrorists, the Libyan fighting groups, Al-Qaeda, and it was Qatar, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. So let me just put this in perspective so you appreciate why this is important. So Hillary Clinton, while she was Secretary of State and the most important foreign policy person in the United States, was dealing with Saudi Arabia, selling them the largest arms group in history. It was close, I think, to $96 billion. They actually celebrated with a party at the State Department when that went through, knowing full well that Saudi Arabia was using the arms that she, Hillary Clinton, and Barack Obama had sold to Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Arabia was then giving those to terrorists to overthrow Gaddafi. And guess what? Saudi Arabia then gave Hillary Clinton's foundation tens of millions of dollars. In fact, everyone who bought arms from Hillary Clinton and the State Department got money to the Clinton Foundation. And they knew that the terrorists were backed and supported and financed and trained by Saudi Arabia. It's in the emails. Why didn't the mainstream media, why didn't CNN, why didn't 60 Minutes, why didn't 2020, why didn't any of these media in the United States, why didn't they immediately challenge the president, Secretary of State, for aiding and abetting in international war crimes, crimes against humanity, by funding the terrorist? Because that would have been it for her campaign. That would have been it for Barack Obama's legacy. So we live, and Donald Trump is doing the same thing today. So this whole, all the dialogue on terrorism is a fraud. It's a lie. We, the United States, are the primary supporters of terrorism. We're aiding and abetting Saudi Arabia, a country that's somewhere in the 16th century, beheading gays, beheading women, flogging women who've been raped. They just gave a woman a 5-year jail cell and a term and 1,000 flogs. Well, you beat someone 1,000 times, you're going to kill him because she was raped. So where's the feminist movement raising hell about that? Where's Hillary Clinton, all the women who care about women? I want to see them. I want to see them picketing the Saudi Arabian embassy. Yeah. Now, listen to this, and then we're going to go to our guest.
One story has monopolized President Trump's time in office like no other, especially on CNN. Russia. In fact, since the inauguration, CNN has mentioned Russia on their air nearly 16,000 times. So we sent our undercover reporters inside CNN to understand why, and to determine if CNN even believes that the story is even real. You're not going to believe what you're about to hear, or maybe you will. I'd like to introduce you to CNN's supervising producer, John Bonifield, in Atlanta.
So you believe like the Russia thing's a little crazy, right?
Even if Russia was trying to swing an election, We try to swing their elections. We're in our CIA and doing shit all the time. Like, we're out there trying to manipulate governments. Like, you win because you know the game and you play it right. She didn't play it right.
The more I see them constantly, like, Russia this, Russia that.
Because it's ratings.
Because ratings?
Our ratings are incredible right now.
In the month of May, CNN's ratings were significantly higher than they were the year before. The Russia story and Trump have made CNN millions.
Because of...
My boss, a couple days yesterday, we were having a discussion about this dental shoot. And he's like, I just want you to know what we're up against here. And he goes, just to give you some context, President Trump pulled out of the climate accords. And for a day and a half, we covered the climate accords, and the CEO of CNN said in our internal meeting, he said, good job, everybody, covering the climate accords, but we're done with it. Let's get back to Russia.
the CEO?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So even the climate accords, he was like, okay, a day or so, but we're moving back to Russia.
Bonifield says CNN's CEO Jeff Zucker demanded that his news channel get back to the ratings winner that Russia is for CNN. Was that an editorial call or a business call?
I understand it's all ratings, right?
Oh, it's a business. It's a business. People are like, the media has like an ethical... But all the nice cutesy little ethics that used to get talked about in journalism school, you're just like... That's adorable. That's adorable. Yeah, this is a business. Especially cable news. You know, cable news isn't the New York Times, and it's not even like NBC News. It's NBC News still gets 20 million viewers a night. Cable news is getting a million. So they gotta do what they gotta do to make their money. Thing. And so I love the news business, but I
find it so fascinating.
I'm very cynical about it. At the same time, so are most of my colleagues.
Yeah, it's like
I'm not alone.
Bonifield has worked for CNN as a journalist and producer for nearly 15 years.
Say, there you have it. One of the inside senior producers saying he's cynical, as are his colleagues, but it's all about the ratings, and ratings mean profit, and it has nothing to do, because also in here, I don't have time to play, but he says, and you can see the whole thing, he says that they don't have any smoking gun, they don't have any evidence, and he understands why Trump might be, you know, angry because of this this kind of attack. So they have no proof. As a journalist, as someone who's broken over 300 stories, you only take to the public what you can prove that's objective and honest. They're taking information based upon hypothesis, prejudice, ideology, fake news, where they have no evidence. And then the American public are supposed to accept or reject this. And that's why people have lost trust in the journalist of America, from the New York Times to CNN, to the Washington Post, to NPR. Because who pays the bills decides what is news and what is not, what is legitimate, what is not. Now let's go over and say hello to my guest who is standing by. He's in the Ozark Mountains. He is Dr. Andrew Harvey. He's an internationally renowned religious scholar, an author and teacher, over 30 books. He's the founder of the Institute of Sacred Activism, and he also... was born in India, but studied at Oxford and taught at Oxford and Cornell and California Institute of Integral Studies. And he's received many awards. And one of his books is The Hope, A Guide to Sacred Activism, which won the Nautilus Silver Award for Social Change. And his most recent co-written with Carolyn Baker is Return to Joy. His website is andrewharvey.net. Nice to have you with us today, Andrew.
Lovely to be with you, Gary, and so... I'm so honored.
Thank you. Andrew, I'd like to focus this discussion today on the emerging millennial generation, which has been targeted for administration as well as disregard and disdain. And there is a neologic, somewhat derogatory term associated with millennials called Generation Snowflake.
Yes.
And that term was taken from the novel Fight Club, and it refers
yes.
to their oversensitive nature and being prone to taking offense more easily. In many respects, they are more emotionally vulnerable and less resilient than previous generations, and it's been characterized as a kind of postmodern Victorianism. They are more easily distressed by ideas that run contrary to their own worldviews, and as we see from many statistical studies, they have more mental health issues such as ADD and ADHD. And the media has even describe millennials who oppose Trump and sided with Bernie Sanders as snowflakes. I disagree with that. Clearly, I find there are large cultural differences between the millennials and our boomer generation and the generation of our parents. And of course, the world millennials are growing up in is vastly different than our own. Nevertheless, it's extremely important for the older generation to understand millennials better, and for the sake of the future, for our generation's wise elders, people such as yourself and Chris Hedges and Cornel West and Rabbi Lerner, and our progressive politicians and academics and visionaries to better lead and guide them into the dystopian future our generation's hubris and greed has created for them to inherit.
Right.
So as an educator, as a spiritual figure who has worked with younger generations, I'd like you to begin by sharing your perceptions of the distinguishing characteristics of millennials that removes them from the boomers, and also, what are the millennials' most pronounced strengths and weaknesses, in your opinion? The forum is yours.
Well, first of all, thank you, Gary. First of all, I'd love to say that I have many, many millennial pupils and spiritual clients, and what characterizes them all is that they know that they're in a society that is potentially heading towards extinction. They are under absolutely no illusions about the powers that be. They're under no illusions about the environmental crisis. They're under no illusions about the cynical love of power and money and status that rules our culture. And that is one very deep difference between them and the baby boomers. I have many baby boomer spiritual clients, and most of them are still stuck in a fake optimism, a fake cheerfulness, a sense that things will work out, come what may. And I find that the millennial response is potentially far more mature, far more realistic. So I'd like to begin by that. And one of the things that I'm doing, in fact, is writing a book about sacred activism for millennials. And I begin the book, which I'm writing with my friend Adam Bucko, by really apologizing to them for having been part of a generation that drank Chardonnay while the world burned, that came up with very tepid solutions to very overwhelming problems, that did nothing about environmental chaos, that did nothing about the growth of a capitalist order that now strangles the poor and devastates the planet. Where they are very strong, it seems to me, is in their tolerance. I find that most of the millennials I meet have no problems with gay people, with transgender people. They're much more aware of the complexity and fluidity of sexuality than our generation was. I find that they're extremely alert to the media and its distortions because they've been brought up in a media world and have had to develop very subtle and intelligent ways of sorting out truth from falsity. And I find that they have a confused but passionate hunger for justice and for harmony and for compassion towards other species. So I have a lot of hope in my millennial friends. Where they seem to me to be weak is really in three things. The first is that very few of them have yet understood that in order to be able to begin to deal with the world as crazy and violent and chaotic as ours, it's essential to have a spiritual practice. It's essential to be able to connect with the inner source and to find there the peace and the joy and the calm and the perspective and the discernment that are necessary. And it's very important, too, that because the only way in which you can stand what's happening is from the calm of the self. So I find them lacking in a commitment to authentic spiritual practice, and that's one of the things that I constantly beg them to do, because I know where they're going, as you know where they're going, into an extremely dystopian future, and I know how hard it is to stay sane in an insane world, and I know that the only way to do that is by having both a deep spiritual commitment and a real mission that corresponds to your deep hunger for change. The second weakness that I see in them is that they are addicted to social media, most of them, and that their concentration is constantly being disheveled by this fake community that social media opens up. I was with a very talented photographer in India who's in his late 20s, and we were being immersed in Benares, in the most holy, wildest, craziest city on earth, but he was constantly on his phone connecting with all the people at home. He took some amazing photographs for a book that we were doing, but I felt, God, he's always having to connect on social media, which doesn't allow him to immerse himself in this new world, which could be revolutionary and transformative for him if only he would turn the media off and attend to the new world exploding within and beyond him. So that's the second weakness. The third weakness is that because of their openness and lucidity about this horrendous crisis that we're in, they can very easily fall into a kind of addicted, nihilistic cynicism about all power, cynicism about any real reaction to this, and that they really truly are often threatened by a despair that isn't helpful. So those are the three things that I think are their potential weaknesses, but I cannot stress enough how amazed I am at the emotional and sexual and spiritual progress that some of them have made, and at the quality of honesty that I see in them about our world.
Thank you. I appreciate that oversight. When we look back at the boomer 20-somethings during the late 1960s and early 70s, there was clearly individuals who emerged as powerful leaders and visionaries. Tom Hayden, Jerry Rubin, who was a close friend of mine, Rabbi Michael Lerner, Abby Hoffman, Angela Davis, and other SDS leaders. They were very dynamic and progressive young African-American political radicals like Huey Newton and Stokely Carmichael, who also was a friend. And young intellectuals in their 20s founded many of the important publications as subversive sources of information that continue today. Rolling Stone, the Whole Earth Catalog, and a bit earlier there was Ramparts magazine. And the musicians at that time were much more than celebrities. Music was more of a form of activism and a break from the past than a ticket to a huge mansion in Beverly Hills. And many were political activists. Jimi Hendrix, Joan Baez, Country Joe and the Fish, Sly and the Family Stone, and bands from the San Francisco and scenes such as Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane. So when you look back at our generation and you look today, what do you see in common, and where are these young people using their celebrity, using their creativity to create a new direction, a new revolution?
This is very problematic. There are some who are using their prestige in honorable ways. I think of Beyoncé, for example, who has truly pushed the envelope both in her passion for the empowerment of women and in her willingness to stand up for the agony of what the African Americans are continuing to live. I think of other rappers and other singers who have really devoted themselves to honorable causes. I think of celebrities like Brad Pitt, who has used his prestige to build houses in New Orleans for those who were attacked by the flood. There are amazing examples of people who are really stepping up to be voices. Look at what Jimmy Kimmel was able to achieve in the national consciousness by really weeping on television about what has happened to him and his own family and his own initiation into the pain that so many people will be going through if this health care bill gets through. Having said that, I think that my own experience of publishing and my own experience through my friendships with stars and singers of the commercial world that now has a stranglehold over the arts. What this means in practice is that it's very hard for a major star or singer or public figure to step outside the box too far, because they then will have terrible backlash and lose commercially. So there are these tremendous tensions between the desire to stand up and be an authentic voice for change and an authentic voice for justice and the grueling and insane demands of staying on top, of staying relevant, of staying saleable. And these are the tensions that I see.
Good. I would agree with that. Andrew, we're going to invite you back for a full hour on the Progressive Commentary to continue this discussion. But we're out of time now, and I want to thank you. His latest book is Return to Joy and The Hope, A Guide to Sacred Activism, andrewharvey.net. Nice to be with you again today, Andrew.
Thank you so much, Gary. God bless you.
And we'll have him back for a full hour. We're out of time. And I want to thank all of you for watching and listening in. And tonight at 7 p.m. is the Progressive Commentary Hour. You won't want to miss that. What Happened to Our Sacredness? It's going to be the theme. And also this coming Saturday begins a four-week, four-Saturday health support group for weight control, diabetes, and arthritis. You can call 646-926-5422. We're going to end our show today with someone who sent us a tape. I don't know who, thank you. And it's just of a party. There were 5,000 people that night from beginning to end over a four-hour period who came just to celebrate. Our audience does. We'll have another one this summer. See if you can find yourself in this mass of humanity enjoying themselves.